I'd like to pick up the theme of our retreat a little bit more. And aware that we've spoken a lot about dispassion. And I'm going to speak some more about dispassion. Because I have a great passion for it. And open up a little bit more around passion as well. But as I say that, I just want you to sense your own body and heart as I say, yeah, I'm going to speak about dispassion some more. Just sense what happens. Because it may be for some that the seemingly the opposite arises. And hopefully I'll show that they don't have to be opposites, but you know, those of you who've practiced the Brahma-viharas know well that if you turn the heart towards metta through intention and activity, if there are any lurking pockets or tendencies towards aversion, they will show up, right? If we turn towards the practice of joy deliberately, then very often pockets of what seem like the opposite, the grief or the sorrow, can arise. When the theme in the room is joy, then those of us, after a certain point, go, oh, can you stop talking about joy? This is terrible, right? So if, when we bring the topic of dispassion again, some of you are enraged, full of heat. No, enough dispassion. Give me the juicy bit. Then you're in the right place. You're in the right place. So a little bit more about dispassion. In the Pali Canon, the body of work where the teachings come from, and I mentioned on the very, very first night, the opening night, this term, dispassion, viraga in Pali, appears over 90 times in a very particular context. So it's not just a nice idea and we just picked it up. It appears very often in a very particular context. And it comes together with the words seclusion. It comes in a triad: seclusion, dispassion, cessation. And then the sentence goes on: yielding in surrender, maturing into relinquishment. You know, this nice word I used this morning, relinquishment, where something is relinquished. So this set of concepts appears many, many times. Viraga, the word given for dispassion, comes from the word raga, which many of you will know from Indian music. It's the kind of the mood, the raga is the mood of the music. It's also the word given to the color red. Raga is red. And in Buddhist psychology, passion, raga, means the coloring of the mind with the red of passion. Ragati is to redden, to make red. Viragati is to lose the redness of things. So just feel your heart as I say that. And look outside at the weather. And you know, that might be a different prospect in hot India, to lose the redness of things, than in northern climes where it's pretty much black and white today. I mean, I might not be seeing very clearly, but you know, so you know, you have to also consider these terms come from a context and embedded in a landscape, and yet we all know, we can all recognize the heat and the fire of the reddening of the mind, right? So viraga is the fading away of passion, fading away of the burning quality. And it could sound boring. Does it sound boring to anyone? Maybe not. Maybe if you're practitioners, you know something is called Because while passion, if we, and hopefully we can start to discriminate more and more clearly the word passion and break it up into useful ways of conceiving and thinking about it. It could sound boring, things turning pale, losing their redness, when only for everything's pale enough at the moment. But from the Dhamma perspective, it says that the effect of passion on our mind does not always support letting go. The effect of passion on our mind does not support letting go. It might be vivifying, it might be enlivening, but it is seldom a foundation for happiness. Right? It might be stimulating, but in and of itself, it's not a foundation for happiness. When our mind is inflamed by passion, without any training with that, we are not usually at our clearest. We may feel at our clearest. You know, when you're hot and full of anger, it feels clear in a kind of way, doesn't it? It's like, I know that you are anger, or let's say lust, right? We're hot with something. It's like, yes, it's very clear. The fire is bright in us. The illumination is strong. And it's you, right? That are either the cause of my happiness or my distress. The mind narrows around. Something is illuminated and it feels very, very convincing. So we're not always at our clearest when we're full with passion. So the training in viraga is a powerful training. And we were practicing this today. If things lose their color, you are still capable of attending to them. Things don't call so loud in consciousness, and you are still capable of attending to them. So we have meditative exercises where we deliberately let the intensity and color of things fade. And this does a number of things, but one is that it reconciles us with the fading nature of much of our experience. Much of our experience falls off the picture when I only rely on the things that attract me or repel me. A lot of existence, a lot of the mystery of what's possible to see doesn't become available to us when we are only guided by our passions. So in this practice, we yield, surrender, yield, mature into relinquishment. We stop trying to protect a construct of who I am, of who you are, my cherished ideas about how wonderful you are, how terrible you are. We stop trying to protect a construct, and in therein lies peace. Seclusion, dispassion, cessation, maturing in surrender. And we've been practicing ways of seeing and views that support this dispassion. In fact, dispassion is a view. It's not a state to be arrived at. Dispassionate states can be known, but it's a view. It's not a philosophical position about the nature of reality. It's a view that supports unbinding and ceasing. I remember sitting with one of my teachers, the monk I told you about today, Ajahn Sachito, on a retreat. And it was maybe 3 or 4 days in like this. And I think I was sitting, I wasn't obviously in this room, but, you know, somewhere around there. And I can't remember, I don't think my experience was terrible or lovely or kind of in between. And this big, solid man, a monk for 40 years, who's matured And he would say so. I'm not being patronizing. He would say so. Right? Really matured. And somewhere from inside, he spoke and transmitted, and he used these words. He said, the dispassion that can hold passion. And I think at the time there was some kind of emotion happening, and I didn't know how to work with it or be with it. And he said these words, the dispassion that can hold passion, in this case some upset or pain. And I didn't even know completely what he meant or how you can do that, but something penetrated my heart. And there was tears start to come out of my eyes of recognizing something compassionate in that view. That I wasn't being asked to become colorless. I was allowed to let things become colorless. But if they are not me and they are not mine, that doesn't mean that we lose color. Sometimes we can, I could certainly think, and we can easily think it with the images of Buddhas that we see in perfect equanimity, with this concept highlighted called dispassion. Clearly it's important in the tradition. And then we can see the images and we can recognize it's really good not to just act out all of our stuff, and we could easily start to have a binary view that passion is the opposite of dispassion. But there is a dispassion that can hold passion, that can let it fade, is not me or mine, and can let the color of the heart be intact and be developed and expand its range and be available for what is beautiful and what is rich. But I think there's a process of sifting here. Sifting and discriminating, because the strong emotions as they arise can feel so convincing. They feel like me, right? They feel like who I am. So there's a work of wisdom if we want to know a passion that is wise. That is not just that I flatten my heart and flatten my soul and flatten my mind so that I don't cause any messes in the world. If we want to know that, then we do well to study dispassion. From the text, what you might like to hear, or a few quotes from the, I think these are from the Sutta Nipata. And remember the context. The word passion, of course, wouldn't have been English for a start. I don't know, what's the word for passion in Finnish?
Intohimo.
Right. Wouldn't have been that either.
It's like enthusiastic lust.
Oh, that's a good one. Oh, we could have another retreat next time called Enthusiastic Lust and Less Enthusiastic Lust. But remember, it's from North India, so the context of the word is going to have completely different sense. It's going to have, not completely different, a very different sense of how that comes into being. I'll say a little bit more about that later. So, and it's quite dramatic language when they translated it into English, having pulled out the dart of passion and going mindfully, he does not crave for this world or the next. Having pulled out the dart of passion and faring mindfully, he does not crave for this world or the next. How's that sound? He delights neither in passion nor dispassion. Right? You know how we can delight in our own passions, like, oh, this is me now, this is the juicy stuff. Or, oh God, it's me, terrible. Or delight in the dispassion, oh, phew, this better. I'm going to hang out here for the rest of my life. Please do not disturb. I put the do not disturb sign. This is the truth. No, he does not delight in passion or dispassion. The sage, these quotes, they're all men, I'm afraid. Let's change it. Add whoever you would like. The sage, a man with nothing in him that he grasps as his, and nothing in him he rejects as his. Do you recognize that that you can be you too? Rather than comparing, oh, blimey, I'm not there yet. More like, oh, I hear it, and it's like, oh, yes, beautiful. Very nice prospect. Beautiful. I recognize that. I recognize that trajectory. The same teacher, actually, Ajahn Sucitto, he talks about the one way of summing up the Dhamma as a transforming of tanha, I'll say what that is, tanha to chanda. And I think you might speak about chanda tomorrow a little bit, so... A transforming of tanha to chanda. Tanha is the hungry, craving heart mind. Give me something. Chanda is the desire that is wholesome and can offer itself to something, whatever it is we want to offer ourselves to, that in this case would be wholesome. Desire, in this case, chanda, is not a hungry seeking for. It is a desire, an engagement to offer yourself, to commit to something, to apply yourself. Chanda is a yes. It's a choice. Tanha is not a choice. Tanha rides us, that hungry impulse to go get something. Do you have it arise here? Hopefully you do, because here we get to see it. It's not wrong. We want to care for it, see that hungry heart where, I don't know how it would arise here, it's such a lovely place. Right, but when you're on retreat, it usually arises, so it might arise when I give you my examples. Tanha, I didn't know it's tanha, I'm just sort of wandering around the meditation center, it was on retreat some time ago, wandering around, tanha, I didn't know it was tanha, just a bit bored, tanha, I don't see that there's tanha, this craving, this hungry heart looking for something, and I go and, probably some of you have heard this before, and I go and hang out in Gaia House at this place where you do the washing up. I'm standing there, hoping for... I mean, at least here there's bookshelves you can look at, right? It's like, there's nothing. It's just beige, colourless, right? This is why most retreat centres are quite colourless, right? So we can work with that fading of our need for it to be colourful. Here you've got lions to look at on the walls. You can't get really bored here, can you? Anyway, there's no lions, it's all beige. And it's England, so the weather's... not even this interesting because there's no snow. And there I am in this washing up area. Just think I'm minding my own business. And I'm looking at where you wash the dishes and where you put the dirty tea towels. You dry the things with the tea towels and there's a bucket that says, dirty tea towels. in red pen. I think it's, I don't know if it's still, it's probably... printed on now, but it was in red pen on one of those white buckets. And after a while, I had a moment of mindfulness, like, what am I doing here? Like, what am I standing around here? What's a nice girl like me doing in a place like this? And I looked at the bucket, and I realized I was bonding with the bucket, because there was nothing else to bond to. There was no one to look at me and say, hi, how are you doing? There was no notes on the notice board that day. I didn't have an interview or group meeting. Nothing had happened much in the meditation. So I was bonding to this bucket. And the reason why was because I had written that. Maybe 5 years before, when I was a manager at the retreat centre, I had written dirty tea towels. And in the absence of anything else reflecting my existence, I stood there with the bucket and I was hoping someone would notice it. It can be really desperate sometimes. You know, really want to see those places. Really want to see those places. This lovely woman, she... I was new to practice, so I thought at the time she was a bit bonkers, but once I sat with my own mind, I knew she wasn't. And she reported at the end of a month-long retreat how she'd gone and stood by the washing line where her husband's trousers were hanging. And it was June in England, and it rained every single day. And so the trousers stayed out because they didn't dry because it kept raining, so they just stayed out. And then I think I was a manager, we were just busy. We didn't bring the trousers. Anyway, his trousers were there for a very long time. And she said she found herself one day just hanging around his trousers and jeans, like on the thing, until she realized, it's like, oh, it's not really him, is it? Right. And she laughed at herself. But at the time, you know, when the heart is that hungry, and it's really looking for to bond to something. It's like, that's tanha. And tanha can have a number of expressions, actually. It's that in the tradition, we talk about three types of tanha. Kama tanha, which is the thirst and the hunger for some kind of sense impression. Something to fill my senses. Like if it gets really quiet here and it gets really, really quiet and it's just like, oh, something, will some bird just sing and make this a bit more interesting? Can I just eat something? Could somebody just say something? Could I just want some kind of sensual impression? Kama tanha. Bawa tanha, the tanha, the craving to become someone. In that moment at the bucket, I was craving to become someone, that someone would notice that I had done something really good 5 years ago, which was right on the bucket. Right? I want to become someone. I want to assert my identity. It's not a big deal with the bucket, but I want to assert my identity in a way that is not in harmony with things. It's like I uproot from this here and now, the timeless seat, and I assert myself, and or I fantasize about making myself into a someone, pop star, or that would be the obvious. Not that all pop stars are suffering from bawa tanha. Some of them very definitely might be. I wouldn't want to assume that they all are. But you know, I mean, that would be a classic example. I want to become someone other than what's here. And vibawa tanha is the craving to not become someone. Right? Which can be the kind of spiritual trap. It's like we tried becoming someone, that didn't work very well, or it didn't get me home. So I want to, okay, I'm going to practice and I'll become no one now. But there's a craving in that. If we want to make the identity out of being a nobody, that has another way we can steal ourselves. You know that, I said this morning, we steal ourselves out of and stop taking responsibility in an interdependent cosmos. Right? I deny and I abdicate from my responsibility as an interdependent soul, utterly dependent on everything, utterly interdependent with everything. And to know that is to sit in this middle way where I'm not demanding that I become, nor insisting that I'm really not important. So the transforming of tanha to chanda. So that's a little bit more about dispassion. What I want us to look at, and I think this will help some of us, is a little brief history, very brief plotted history of our Western inheritance around the idea of dispassion. Right? Because we have our own legacy and heritage with this concept, which is going to have some things in common and be also quite different, and also embedded in a different context than these teachings from North India. Okay. And as you hear, this very, very broad strokes, so it's not in detail, it's not thorough, and it may not be fair in all cases. But, and whoever we are, as modern people living in Northern Europe, we are inheritors of that legacy, whether or not we believe intellectually all the ideas that that legacy gives us. We invariably inherit the both the gifts and the blind spots of that heritage. And see, as you hear, see how you can imagine that could intersect in 2019 through you with a teaching of North India from 2,600 years ago, embedded in a different context, which has timeless Dharma that is absolutely still relevant, brilliantly, penetratingly, in a very sophisticated way, right here and now. And see what our legacy may do as we meet those two together, that may limit our awakening, may limit what's possible for us in our practice. See what you think. So, briefly, a brief history of antibodies. You know, antibodies are normally used in the... Oh, it's a joke. A brief history of antibodies, right? So this Western, as probably many of you know, we're you know, there's a really terrible cost to this, but a little bit of the history, you know, in the Greek era, and you might think, what's the Greeks got to do with me? In a lot, in a way, you know, even if we're secular, modernist, wherever we are, it's all in a trajectory of born out of the same foundations, in a way, you know, a lot of those threads are the same. So whatever esteem for the body there seems to be in the early Greek period, you know, there's this sort of high body image piece. Apparently around the 5th century, this was overtaken by a disdain for physicality. Wisdom and the intellect, it was started to be thought in a number of schools of thought, wisdom and the intellect could have nothing to do with this mere brutality of the body. Such was the view that was arising. And then in the rise of intellectual philosophy, which you can see threaded right through to our secular era, this got stronger, right? We see even in, you know, right through in the Christian heritage, even gorgeous, beautiful St. Francis, who the one who loved the animals and nature, referred to his body as brother ass, like it's a donkey. You know, and donkey, you know, it might be nice if donkeys were given high place on the cosmology at the time, but they weren't. You know, the donkey was the kind of thing that you got to do the legwork, the donkey work, right? So from the Greeks onwards, this association that higher and more abstract is better. Purity and security existed in parallel realms that are eternal, down, meaning body, earth, matter, carnality. Down is ugly. Up is beautiful. And to escape, you have to work your way up. Right? So we've got the sky god that comes, and then the intellect, the privileging of the intellect, etc. Logic, reason, rationality, and sanctity became yoked together. So holiness became yoked with rationality and upwardness. Very brief history. Fast forward to the European Enlightenment, 1650 onwards. Massive brilliant turn scientifically, medically, artistically, religiously, the importance of that Protestant revolution, turning around from the indulgences and the emotionality of the Catholic Church in a way, necessary, all of that turn. And some of the gifts from that, that gift to be able to see for oneself, starts to become highly valued, right? The gift to be able to get a distance on something and perspective and look at something from a privileged vantage point. So hence in science, in medicine, in art, being able to open the view that way, to see something so-called clearly, we get perspective and all of the scientific advances that that gives us. Medical advances, artistic revolution, new religious view where the individual becomes more important from in the Protestant revolution, who can work for them, work their own path to God. Right. Many very important things. But just taking that one, that dispassion becomes a high value, certainly medically, scientifically, that's seen then as the way you find out the truth. Getting a distance on something. And I remember this picture I tore out of the newspaper when I was a young student. I was about 19. And it was an old English painting, I think, of, it's quite a famous one, I think, probably used in the feminist revolution, I imagine. But the picture sort of disturbed me, and it was a Victorian England image painting of a medical scene with, like, had like 30 men, and this is not an anti-men. We're all wounded by the whole legacy here. But there's all these lovely men in medical people in their suits, standing up straight, looking at this woman who was kind of in this sort of bodice, kind of doing this and falling backwards, sort of hysterical, probably. Not surprised, really. You can imagine that. Funny. And they're kind of looking at her like, well, what'd you do with one of these? You know, has that kind of, that look. So this isn't a critique on gender at this point. It's more that, because we can be any gender and look from this distance at our own body or another body. Right. But to see that which gave us so much to look from a distance, when it becomes the valid way of knowing, and the only valid way of knowing, is objectifying. At worst, it's voyeuristic, can become dissociated, it's still risen above. And many, many things cannot be known by doing that. Many things can, but not completely. So dispassion, you know, to have a dispassionate view, the doctor's supposed to be dispassionate. And then we have an idea that we're rational. One of my lovely brothers, he's the most emotional person in my family, but he claims to be the most non-emotional person in my family. And I love him very much. But he insists that his choices are all rational when he buys things and when he... And it's like, well, ask any advertiser. They know we're not rational beings. That's how it works. He's like, no, I want this, I don't know. And it's not that his mind is useless, he's bright, you know. But we're not. We're not one faculty, we're multiple. And in that dispassionate view, the Western legacy of it, it's often, usually, missing multiple other ways of knowing. That at that same time as the rise of the European Enlightenment were other ways of knowing, instinctual ways of knowing, energetic ways of knowing, imaginative ways of knowing, emotional ways of knowing, the kinds of knowing of the medicine people of Europe, all those kinds of knowing starting to be pushed down, oppressed, wiped out. I don't know how it was in Finland here. I don't know, actually, the legacy, but the burning of the witches, the burning of those with other ways of knowing, comes at the same time as the rise of dispassion. Right? So, if when we come to hear a teaching of dispassion, we can tell there's something really, really important here in this teaching. But if part of us says, hey, wait a sec, we can also usefully discriminate what's happening there. Okay. I remember one of my teachers, and it was really helpful. I had to do the work of discriminating for myself. He used to sit at the front. He was a really brilliant Dharma teacher. And he used to say, I won't say his name, let's call him X. only because I need his name in the sentence. And he used to, and he was, you know, he really could teach what he taught really well. You know, he could really point to something that was really helpful. Anyway, he would sit there sometimes, he'd say, this small little event called X. He would refer to himself. This small little event and called Catherine, and I would be making the equivalent. This small little event called Catherine. And part of me would hear him, and I loved him, and I learned a lot from him. And I would think, yeah, that's right, we're not as important as we think. That's right. But something also hurt my heart. And I thought, oh, that's just my ego. That's just my ego. That's because I want to think I'm important, and I don't like that he's saying that. And that will have been part of the truth, I think. Part of it will have been my ego, and part of it will have been my, no, don't say I'm not important. And maybe we need to keep listening and discriminate what might be, and I can't say that he was doing this, I have to take responsibility for how I'm hearing it. But can I go deeper with that, without making him wrong, without making me wrong? Can I listen deeper? What's the legacy of my own overlooking of myself? What's my yearning for a dispassion and a freedom that is timeless? What is my insistence to assert myself as a bhava tanha? How do we consider when then we hear the teachings, brilliant, necessary, where the Buddha compares the body. He says, think of your body like a termite's nest. Okay, after, if I've just inherited that legacy, and then it's like, think of my body like a termite's nest, it's like, oh shit. I'm out of here. It's bad news from that line, and it's pretty bad news from that line. It's a different line. I'm not saying they were all marvelously enlightened in that era. I'm not wanting to idealize northern India of 2,600 years ago. Probably some of it was brutal. But differently so, with different conceptions and different embedded ideas. And so when I hear, and what he means, think of your body like a termite's nest, it's like it gets constructed. Right? You know, amazing. Have you seen those ones in Australia, these ants? They make these like incredible things. So I could hear it like, wow, I'm an incredible thing. But they make these things, and they're just built up out of the conditions. And they'll crumble again when the conditions have changed. Think of our body that way. It's not permanent. It's made of conditions. Have we heard that before? But I do well to check what heart that's landing into. I do well to bring my heart along and not come to the dispassion that's, oh, this is a termite's nest. There's one practice in the first foundation of mindfulness where there's many reflections on body, as well as the mindfulness of breathing and mindfulness of body. And one is the contemplation of the 32 parts of the body. And I remember the first monk I met in India, a Thai monk, you know, it's practice there, you have like a rosary beads and he's just reflecting on all those parts, probably in his own language. But basically it's like, lungs, phlegm, kidneys, spittle, pus, bile, you know, and you go through all these rather unlovely parts of the body just to kind of cool out your heat a bit, right? So you kind of go through and you remind yourself of all the, it's bits, you kind of cut a bit off, it's not me or mine, you know. It's made up of parts. I suspect he gave this practice to his young monks and nuns who were just too hot for their own good, just to cool out their lust a little bit, right? It got translated in English, this asubha, I think it is in Pali. It got translated in Pali, I think it really more literally means the unlovely, meaning you think the body's so lovely, just reflect on its unloveliness for a little bit. In Victorian English, they translated it, that as cultivating disgust for the body. It's like, so here's my bit, which probably you don't have as much. You know, we have our own, like, funny English thing going around bodies, but, you know, I think you might have a little, you've probably got other issues, but not the same one as that, right? Just imagine that we inherit that, and that's the language that the Dharma's come into, and people think, can end up thinking, oh, okay. And imagine that coming together with a history where we've had to come out of our body if the impacts have been too strong, or if it has been seen with the eyes of objectification, where we may have dissociated. Imagine what healing is going to be part of that journey if we wish to pick up this teaching and let it really do for us and for our community and for our world what is possible, what I really believe is possible with this timeless Dhamma meets time, and in this case, Northern Europe in 2019. So just a little bit more than to point us in a part of the direction that we'll be heading. Our passion. And let's start here with the reddening, the strong, hard to handle things that can arise for us while we're here. And just a couple of examples, because what happens when we sit in seclusion with ourselves? I don't mean there's nobody here, but chitta is translated as sometimes as heart, sometimes as heart mind, sometimes as mind. But chitta, the third foundation of mindfulness, really is, I would say, it's you. You are chitta. Chitta is our sensitive. It's not just located to our emotional heart. It's our sensitive, receptive, pulsing you that can be impacted. So when Ajahn Sucitto said that thing about passion and dispassion, it impacted me. Like my chitta was open and resonant and available to be impacted by that. We're impacted, we can impact. The chitta is resonant, sensitive, receptive, alive. And when we practice here, our chitta resonance opens. It may have been parts closed down when things have been too much to bear in our life. Emotions, impacts, knocks, etc. We may have closed parts down, hardened, tightened, fragmented. In the healing of that, in the mindfulness of the body breathing, the resonators open again. We start to resonate more. We start to feel more. And as we do, old residues of the chitta can start to surface. Old pain, old sorrow, old bitterness, rage. It's not all old stuff, right? Some can be triggered here and now. But those old residues can surface and come to be healed, come to be known, come to be seen kindly and wisely with compassion and wisdom. also what can come is not just our pain, right? Also, as the citta opens, we sense directly for ourselves the uprightness, the nobility, the courage, the beauty, the loveliness, the steadfastness. These are qualities that we can actually sense through being them from the inside, so to speak. So we will say more about how to work with these strong charges that can arise in the citta, in the heart, mind, body, as we practice here, to work with them for healing and to work with them as allowing the color, the redness, to be allowed to not be taken as me or mine. Allows the citta to become more flexible, more versatile. It has more, if it was an instrument, it has more keys on its keyboard available to respond and be in the world. I was going to give an example, but I'm also aware it's also probably good not to go on too long. So let's wait for the examples. We will get there.
Could you give one example?
One. A hot one or a cool one? Because part of it is, often we, you know, we think, because of this red issue, a red story with the raga part, we can think it's all about strong emotions, but I would say also that passion, the being caught in the contents of our own mind, caught by the colouring of our own mind, is also to do with how compelled we are to take it as me or mine and real, and the truth. And that can also apply to things that aren't so colourful, like the tendency to want to just fade away and go to sleep on ourselves. I would call that a passion as well, in the negative sense of the word, where we just want to, I'm not hot, I'm not bothered, but I've gone. And that, to the extent that that's compelling for us, which we'll also see, that's less red, but is also a passion in that it's compelling. It's a compelling response sometimes. That's what I meant by cool.
Sounds like you're going for the cool example.
Yeah, I should go for the cool example. But I want to give a hot example.
Well, we're not going anywhere.
I think, I mean, in a way, that was almost an example that talking about the fading away, which is different than the fading of phenomena or the fading of perception. It's when I disappear. I think I will give a hot example because I think it's easier to see to start with also. So retreat is a really good place for this because you will be impacted by each other. Have you noticed? You know, we're impacted by, and by us. We'll impact you probably for better and for worse. Sorry about that. I can sign the disclaimer beforehand. We do, we just impact each other. That's what we do as humans. If we try to not impact anyone, we do the Vibhava thing and we disappear out. It's like you get the whole lot here. Yeah. So on a retreat, 3 month retreat, sitting, and there was five teachers teaching the retreat, and one of them I didn't like. Always happens. Actually it doesn't anymore. Oh, that's pretty good. Sometimes, oh, that's a bit, that's good, yeah. I didn't know I didn't like her. I couldn't own that to myself. I just thought she was wrong. Yeah, I don't know that I'm not even close enough to myself to recognize that there's aversion. I just thought she shouldn't be there. Right? You know that difference? Once I know it's aversion, I start to take a bit of responsibility. That took me about 2 weeks into that retreat. It was actually just, she just doesn't do it right. You know, she's blah, blah, blah. What my mind was doing around it. And after, so she'd leave the platform and go. And she'd gone, and I'd still be going, blah, 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 why don't they? And she spoils this. Mumble, 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 but no. But took a couple of weeks to see that, and then, it might sound really slow, but it, you know, things dawn on us when they dawn on us. You can't, don't they? Isn't it funny when you see something, you go, oh, how come I never saw that before? Anyway, it's like, oh, oh. She's gone. But I'm still here. Oh. So it took 2 weeks to actually get to the first stage of mindfulness, which was actually recognize, oh, there's aversion here. Wow. And then when I turned towards it, I recognized that there was hatred there. And that's really hard to see, because if you're supposed to be a nice person and you think you're a nice person, it's really alarming to see that you're not. And not that I'm now not a nice person. I think the whole point about not self is that I'm neither a nice person nor not a nice person. But on the way to understanding that a bit more, I have to see that those identities I've had of thought, thinking I was a really nice person, it's an anthill, right? That's also an anthill. So there's hatred, wow, okay. Can I sense it in the body? Can I own it? Can I hold that with dispassion? Can I breathe? Can I see the counter pattern, which says, you shouldn't have hatred? That's really bad. Spin, spin, spin. Two lots of spinning. Two lots of spinning. Hatred. You're wrong for hatred. Shouldn't you just follow your breath? Okay, I'll try and follow my breath. Right? And that's how it goes. It's like we make a counter self called a meditator who's hopefully going to get out of this mess. And right? Oh, shit. Right? And then, like, you sit long enough with yourself and with enough faith, like, okay, no, there is something here, you know? Okay, okay. Okay, self-view starts to change. Starts then to go, oh, I'm a hateful person. No, that's just another place to try and get some bearings. But can I sense it in the body? Can I feel there was kind of like, it's different than hot, actually. Hatred's quite interesting. If you've got to study it, ask me, I know a lot about it. It's not hot, it's sometimes cold, it's sometimes thick, it's sometimes it's not so obvious. It's like a thick tar, kind of just like clogging up the heart. Can feel dispassionate, right? You know, that's one of the really the horrible kinds of dispassion where people can commit certain acts to other beings. Because, not even angry ones, but hateful ones in nations, peoples, species, animals, earths. Because the capacity to resonate has got so clogged up, thickened. That's hatred. And then the healing of holding that kindly, it's not me or mine, doesn't mean it just disappears. Some things do when you see them like that. Some things we want to and are called on, and we get cultivated by coming close, hanging with compassion. Here's where our passion can be. The compassion, the feeling along with, the pulsating along with even my hatred. Can I stay? Can I not make it me or mine? Can I not make it not me or mine? What was that about the sage? The sage. You remember the one I was thinking of? Does any of you memorize it by heart when I said it? The sage. Where's he gone? Where's my sage? Oh, was he on there? Oh, yeah. A sage now is a woman with nothing in her that she grasps as hers and nothing in her that she rejects as hers. And the sage doesn't mean those things don't arise. In fact, as the sage is maturing into the sage, more things can arise. More things can arise. Okay, to be continued. Let's sit for a minute together.